Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief of Eureka Report, and joining me today in the Money Cafe, well, remotely, of course, because we're in lockdown, is my son, Chris Kohler, business, finance and property reporter on Nine News. Good morning, Critty.
Good to be with you. Well, remotely, good to be with you from my office and you're, I think, at home.
I certainly am. And yes, I called you Critty, which is your nickname in our family.
Thanks. Now everyone knows it.
Thanks to your mother, now everyone knows it, which is which I think is reasonable.
Yeah, I think so too. It's become now, Uncle Critty lately, which is fine.
Uncle Critty, exactly. There's lots of other grandchildren apart from yours. Mm. Your wonderful son John. Tell us about John today. What sort of night have you had with him?
He decides that the day's going to begin at about 4 a.m, which is kind of, it's his prerogative as a 3-month-old, I guess. The mornings have changed a bit. It was previously to his arrival listening to things like news radio in the morning, and now it's a song called Banana Phone cranked at full volume, which is which is going to be in my head all day, I think. But that's okay too, because we absolutely love the boy.
I should explain to everyone that Chris was born in 1988 when I was 36. I was doing Chanticleer at the time, and it is the case that much of my 40s and 50s were spent throwing balls at him in the nets and watching him play cricket on the sidelines endlessly, which was a wonderful day, a wonderful way to spend my weekends, I must say. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever fully thanked you for all of the balls you chucked down at me in the backyard and in the nets and things like that, but it's certainly appreciated. I'm sorry I never became a more accomplished cricketer despite your efforts, but I suppose as I got older that kind of became more more other kinds of, you know, you were throwing balls down to me in the more business and finance and economics type of space, you know, asking me questions, see what I reckon, and that's appreciated too.
Metaphorical balls.
Exactly.
Perhaps. Well, look, it doesn't matter whether you became a cricketer or not. I mean, apart from anything else, it's probably a dicey career to try to take on being a cricketer. There's not many places in the Australian team.
That's true.
I must say it is the case that there's nothing like throwing balls and so on to bond you. So Chris and I, everyone, have bonded in the nets over many, many, many years.
Yeah, that's true. I'm hoping to do the same thing with my son. But the thing that I won't be able to provide him that you were able to provide me was an excellent option for juniors umpiring. And that's because you're missing, and this is a bit of a reveal for everyone, you're missing your right index finger, which made you the perfect choice for juniors umpiring because you could never really give us out.
Oh, well, no, I gave you half out.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. A stumpy finger waved in the air occasionally.
Yes. Now, the thing that strikes me about Nine News, which is perhaps slightly different to the ABC News, which I'm on, is that you tend to get out and about and talk to people and, do lots of case studies. And so tell us a bit about what you've been learning about both property, because you're focusing on property and business. Give us a bit of an update as to what you've been finding out. Talking to both real estate agents and small business people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing, as you say, we do get out there, and on the property side of things, I was previously in previous roles just looking at the macro side of property, you know, stuff economists were saying, analyst predictions, looking at notes and things like that. And now I'm going to 2 or 3 auctions every single Saturday, pretty much exclusively in Melbourne. I was doing it in Sydney as well. But, you know, you really do get a bit of a different and kind of a more personal sense of what's going on out there. And, I never fail to be stunned by how frantic things have become on that side of things. You know, the bidding, the kind of the urgency that people have got when they're raising their hands, and it's just become, it's getting very, very intense out there when I'm going around to those sorts of auctions. And so you do get a bit of a different window of insight into the property market. And then on the business side of things, yeah, it's a lot of case studies. You're talking to a lot of business owners, small, mostly hospitality owners.
And they're doing it tough at the moment, aren't they?
Oh, they're being absolutely decimated. It's the same story you're hearing day after day, and it's the same sort of complaints that aren't being addressed, and they just are pulling their hair out. You know, you're talking to them about the fact that, you know, say a kid's party business, which I was at the other day, they had 75 parties lined up for Saturday, all got cancelled, and he said he lost $120,000 in revenue that day. Of course, his rent of $40,000 is still due at the end of the week. And so these people have got no idea what to do, where the money's going to come from. And
they're certainly not getting that sort of money off the government, are they?
No, they're not. And, you know, they're getting sort of $2,000-$3,000 here or there. And for some businesses, that's perfectly good. The Victorian government, I'm speaking about Victoria because we're in Victoria, but other state governments are doing similar things. You know, they've extended it to another $3,000 for Alpine businesses. You know, that's, I'm sure, appreciated. But for an Alpine business in July, if you don't make your money now, you're not going to make it all year. So there are businesses that are just being crushed for a long, long time. And, of course, as we keep talking about, you and I, when we do finance updates on the share market, it's not this problem isn't really being extended to the big businesses. You know, they're looking at massive profits, special dividends, looking at a big profit reporting season as well.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because what we're seeing with these lockdowns in particular is a huge difference between big and small business. Big end of town's fine, small business is being killed, and it's because I suppose that the hospitality and entertainment, those sort of things, are all small businesses.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I don't know what else they could be doing. The Victorian government's talking about they've done $7 billion so far. Federal government brought in those insolvency, Chapter 11 bankruptcy type of rules at the start of the year. I'm curious about what you reckon about whether or not that's a good thing, about whether or not you're going to see a big wave of businesses that are going to collapse, you know, when they're allowed to, I guess.
We thought there would be last year. Was the bankruptcy provisions were loosened, obviously, last, when was it? April, May. And thought, oh, well, when that happens, there'll be a wave of bankruptcies in whenever it was, December, when they were going to be lifted. But there never was. Maybe there will be again, but it's just hard to predict that. I mean, that it didn't actually happen, partly because the spending snapped back pretty quickly. There was a big comeback in the economy, and I think a lot of these businesses kind of suddenly found this they were okay once the lockdowns finished. I mean, it was really kind of lockdown start and finish of the lockdown was when they were doing badly.
Yeah, well, and as a result of that, I suppose a lot of the economists are now predicting that we're going to, spring back pretty well after this lockdown. But I think it's kind of feeling a bit different. Like, I did a story last week on the building supply shortage in the construction space. And those guys are paying a huge amount of money and having extended wait times for things like timber. And now that South Australia's locked down, apparently the Victorian and Eastern states get 40% of their timber from the South Australian mills, which are now locked down. So the problem's getting even worse. And in 3 or 4 weeks, they'll be paying even more and for even less timber. And, we know that the construction industry is still going in various states, but it's a huge, huge problem.
Well, in fact, New South Wales shut down their construction industry. I don't know what's going on in Victoria, but they're still going.
Yeah, they're still going in Victoria, which, that's been something that's been lobbied pretty heavily because it's such a big employer and because there were so many, there was so much money being poured into it, the home builder scheme being one thing. And now they're all sort of saying, well, they brought forward all the land releases. They can't get any more of that. So I think the problems, as you and I talk about occasionally, are just going to keep on rolling from this.
As for the economy generally, everyone's saying now that the September quarter will be negative. The question is how deep. Before Victoria and now South Australia were in the lockdown, they were saying that the New South Wales lockdown would knock about 1.4% off September quarter GDP. That seemed to be roughly the consensus, 1 to 1.4%. So that meant that would mean that a September quarter overall for Australia would be minus 0.7% as a contraction on GDP, which we'd find out in early December for the September quarter. But that was before Victoria and South Australia went into lockdown. So it's likely to be much more than that. So a contraction of overall between 1 and 1.5% for the September quarter. So quite a deep contraction. The only question, I guess, is whether it's two quarters in a row and therefore officially a recession.
Yeah, so you don't get a recession for several decades and then you get two in the space of, 18 months?
Yeah, that's right.
That's pretty funny.
It'll depend on, I suppose, whether the June lockdown in Victoria would make the June quarter negative or whether the lockdowns continue on after the end of September into October and November. We won't know that for a long time, I guess.
No, but I mean, of course, it stands to reason. I think Sydney alone, Greater Sydney, produces, I think, 25%+ of national GDP. You add Melbourne into the mix and our Adelaide, there's absolutely no money getting spent, really.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I think that whether or not it's a recession, and the other thing about it is, as we were talking before, it's confined to individual sectors, really. I mean, I think there's no doubt that small business is in recession. But big business is not. So when you look at the overall, the average is potentially not that deep. But a lot of small businesses are absolutely in recession, aren't they?
Absolutely. Well, yeah. But so what do you say then? Do we need to have a more targeted approach for small businesses? I mean, does it need to be sector based or does it need to be size of business based? Because a lot of the sole traders and partnerships aren't being included in a lot of the programs that have been rolled out. You know, they're really strict on the types of turnover you're allowed to have. There's been a bit of mucking around with things like hospitality versus non-essential retail and, you know, now Alpine businesses in the mix. I mean, do you think that they just need to roll out a big thing of anyone with turnover less than $10 million, whether you're a sole trader, partnership, incorporated, whatever, you get, you know, JobKeeper or some sort of version of it? I don't know.
Well, part of the problem, it seems to me, is that the JobKeeper program that was introduced last year was plundered by business. I mean, there's so many businesses who got the money, didn't need it, and either because their revenue didn't go down or it went up. So, and the problem was that they had to predict in the first couple of weeks of the lockdowns, they had to predict a decline in turnover of either 30% if you're a small business, 50% if you're a large business. And then you got the JobKeeper and you got it no matter what for 6 months. And so a lot of these businesses just had a very short downturn. So they qualified for the JobKeeper at the beginning and then off they went and they were fine. And they ended up at the end of the year well ahead and they still got millions of dollars off the government in JobKeeper. So, and the thing is that although the government is saying that they're not going to require the money to come back and they're trying to bury the fact that a lot of businesses got money they didn't need, I reckon behind the scenes they're saying we can't do that again. That was shocking. And so there's no JobKeeper because it was plundered. By businesses last year, I reckon there's a story in that. I mean, it was the 7:30 had it on last night. They had a big story about it last night, which I'd recommend everybody have a look at if they can on iView.
Yeah, well, so aside from a little bit of bad PR for the businesses that are getting dobbed on, who aren't willing to cough it back up, because a lot of the businesses have said that they'll give it back or give part of it back. And then, so this time around, they're trying to do it so they're giving the money to the individuals, to the employees, and leaving the businesses out of it. But you're right. There's been a bit of, I don't want to say necessarily bad behavior because everyone was very worried this time last year. But a lot of medium and large businesses also trimmed their staff salaries as well, 20, 25%. You know, guys, we all need to band together. Everyone's got to get through this. We need some help. We need you to accept a 20% pay cut. And then that's been the end of the conversation. They've sprung back. A lot of the businesses that did it now are, you know, bigger than they've ever been and incredibly strong. Conversation ends.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Now, listen, before we move on to questions, let's talk a bit more about property. Do you think that there's likely to be another property downturn? How does it feel out there?
I think there will be, yeah. I think there's going to be some pretty intense buying up until the interest rates start to come up again, or at least the calls for that to happen become clearer and sharper. People are still trying to lock in interest rates that are sort of 2%. I mean, any movement up in rates is still coming from such an incredibly low level. But if you listen to the economists, they're still all predicting 18 to 20% national property price gains this calendar year. Of course, about 12% of that got done in the first 6 months, so it's not a massive stretch. But then next year, they're all sort of saying it'll come down to about 5%. The year after that, 0%. So I reckon it's pretty safe to say that the boom is, well, maybe not over, but at least on the downhill now. You know, it seems pretty unlikely that we'll see a crash. There's just so many struts in place to keep it going.
So at the moment, there are no inspections of houses or in-person auctions, are there? So that was the same as what happened last year. What happened was that people took their properties off the market, didn't they? I mean,
it's definitely happening.
Yeah.
That's right. It got frozen. The whole market went into hibernation. Exactly. That is definitely happening. Properties are still transacting. Melburnians particularly seem to be okay with the idea of Zoom and online auctions more than other parts of the country because they got so used to them during the long lockdown. Sydney, interestingly, you can still inspect a property. You have to do it by inspection. You have to book in and go as a one-on-one look through. So they can still do that. They can't have an in-person auction. But about a third of all of the auctions that were booked in for Sydney this weekend have come off and are being either postponed or switched to private treaty or something like that. So they're certainly having the moment that we had this time last year in Melbourne where it's just having a bit of a freezing over kind of moment. If it's anything like Melbourne, it'll spring back incredibly strongly on the other side and you'll see clearance rates strong and you'll see midwinter in Melbourne. Before this lockdown, we were looking at 1,200 auctions on a Saturday, which is massive even for spring. So there was all that pent-up demand for selling that just got unleashed.
Now, you're a millennial. Do you blame baby boomers like me for making housing unaffordable?
That is such a direct question. I love it. No, I don't. I think a lot of boomers have had a pretty good go of it on the property side of things. And I think a lot of the stuff that gets said about millennials and their inability to buy a house because it's their fault is just wildly untrue. And because
you're having smashed avocado.
Well, yeah, that was the classic one. I was, foaming at the mouth when that all was going down. But then also just the stuff about travel. I always found that very frustrating. People saying that millennials travel too much and that's why they can't afford property. And of course, the thing that's neglected with that is that while property prices have skyrocketed, the price of traveling has plummeted. I did the numbers in about 2018 and figured out that the cost of one return trip or the cost of the median property deposit in Melbourne in 1983 was equivalent to 5 return trips to London at the time. And now it's something like 240 return trips to London. So you can have as many of the trips to London as you want. You can have as many smashed avocados as you want. It's not getting any. You're not getting any closer by not doing those things, really.
You should do that. You should do that some again. That'd be interesting because property prices have moved a fair way since 2018. Mind you, the cost of going to London is skyrocketed because because of the pandemic.
Well, that's true. You're right. It's probably not going to work right now. Yeah, but no, I think a lot of the policies are set up in a way that that don't help first home buyers, and I think the stuff that we've been seeing lately isn't really a fix of a problem. It just sort of helps people get into more debt. I kind of don't really like the idea of government guaranteed loans and just helping people get into 98% debt. It just seems a bit of a band-aid, really.
Yes, let's go on to questions, eh?
Sounds good.
First one's from Hamish. It says, "Hi, Alan and Chris. After just becoming a father myself, I've just started to think about ways to teach my child or children about money in a fun and at least practical way. I feel like there actually is a lot of really interesting stuff to learn out there in the finance world, and I wish I was exposed to more earlier. Chris, was there anything that your dad did or said when you were younger that you can remember that really stuck with you in regard to finance, as opposed to cricket?" He doesn't say that. And Alan, was there anything you tried specifically to teach your kids about money? I'm not looking for tricks necessarily, but a fun one I heard about recently was to try and teach your kids about the value of compounding that went something like you pay them an allowance, say monthly, and every time they don't spend that allowance, add an extra 10% to their savings. Obviously, the more they save, the higher the 10% is. And finally, are your brothers and sisters into finance as well? Is it their career also? So did I teach you about money in any way? I can't remember.
Yeah, you did. I mean, look, I watched you on the news. No, we had we chats all the time about money and about things like that. I think
what did you get from me?
Well, look, you always, when I was very young, encouraged me to keep a money box. I remember that, basically a piggy bank. And I can now reveal to you that I basically kept doing that until I was about 28. The idea that cash is a good way of spending and that cash is good stuck with me well into the tapping era. And I think that was something that you imparted on me. And I, on that, I spent a whole year. I set myself a challenge one year when I was 28 or 29. of trying to spend, pay for as much as I possibly could with cash. And anytime I got a $5 bill or a gold coin as change, I would keep it. After the year was up, I ended up buying pretty much all of my wife's engagement ring with that money. So that's pretty good. And I think that there's that was definitely something that you told me about with regard to, you know, allowance and things like that.
I tried to steer all of you away from credit cards, I must say. And that, I think that worked. I don't think any of you have got credit cards now.
I've never had one. And I don't think my sisters have either.
It was mainly because I got absolutely murdered by credit cards.
But you know, well, that's right. What about you? Anything specific? And also to Hamish's question, do you think that idea about the compounding idea is a good one?
Yeah, I do. I think it is. I mean, compounding is an important lesson, and I feel like I never really imparted that sufficiently to you kids. I mean, perhaps hopefully you picked it up off me generally, but I never sat you down and sort of gave you a stiff lecture about the power of compounding and so on, but I and feel like I should have. So I think that sort of practical answer by Hamish is a good idea. As for brothers and sisters, no, they're not into finance, are they?
Not really.
Well, two sisters. Chris has got two sisters, everyone. They're both older than him, and one's an interior designer, one works for me.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, she's actually on maternity leave, having just had another baby. So yeah.
Your grandkid's coming out your ears at the moment. But yeah, no, I think it's certainly important. There's a lot of products at the moment for kids. There's, you know, Spendle, and there's, I think, things like Raise are also a good idea to get kids interested in things like, you know, all of a sudden in passive investing and ETFs, things like that. You can't really get your head around those things too early, I reckon.
Yeah. Have you got the questions in front of you? Can you read the next one?
Sure. Hi, Alan and Co.
Right. This is from Sam.
Excellent. Thank you, Sam. In essence, how are franking credits worked out for an ETF? If there are multiple companies with different franking arrangements, how is that passed on? I have two Vanguard stocks, brackets VGS and VAS, and neither have a franking credit, despite the underlying shares having a franking credit. So that's a fair question. What do you reckon?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I don't own any ETFs, but I'm surprised. Those things have franking?
Well, I reckon it's slightly outrageous if they're not passing on the franking credits, and they should. I had a quick look after seeing this question, and beta shares, which is some of the, I have a couple of beta shares ETFs, and one of theirs says in the information about it that it's 77% franked. So it should be as clear as that, I reckon.
Right. I'm sure that Vanguard's main ETFs would be at least partly franked. I mean, a lot of the stocks they invest in have got limited or zero franking. But a lot of them are 100% franked. So, yeah, look, I don't think so. I mean, I think they have to be franked for sure.
It should be. Would have thought. Do you want to read the next one?
Jeremiah says, hi, Alan and Chris. Firstly, love the podcast, particularly last week with Malcolm Turnbull. I could probably have listened to him speak for hours as well. I have a hypothetical tax-related question about the podcast's topic du jour, Bitcoin. Had I purchased 10 Bitcoin when it first launched and waited out all the volatility that's come with it, I'd now be sitting on a sizable investment for what would have been a small initial buy-in. If I wanted to use that money to purchase a car, for example, rather than sell the coins and incur capital gains, what if I used the coins themselves to buy the car? I imagine I'd avoid paying capital gains tax and would be able to spend the full amount and get some hot, red-hot Ferrari rather than a nice Mercedes. Well, yes, as long as you can find someone who'll take bitcoins for the car. And I'm not aware of anyone selling cars for bitcoins apart from Tesla, are they?
They backed away from that.
That's right.
That was the whole thing. But no, it's a good question. I have absolutely nothing to add. I'm terrible here. That'd be for a good accountant. I'd be able to set you straight there. But it is certainly a good point because a lot of people have been buying crypto in the last year or two and totally forgetting about the capital gains tax implications. And so it's not a bad way of thinking about it, I guess. Can I spend this rather than cash out?
I mean, look, it seems to me that at some point those bitcoins would be turned into cash, therefore that is to say sold. So somebody's going to pay tax on them. Whether if you persuade somebody to do a barter, which is in fact what it is, for a car for 10 bitcoins, that's untaxable. But the person who sold you the car presumably would have to turn the bitcoins into cash and sell them, at which point there'd be capital gains tax. So they would have to build the potential capital gains tax into the price, I would think.
Yeah. Anyway. I suppose the only other thing about Jeremiah, if he's held onto them for a long time, his capital gains tax would be a lot less than if he held it for less than a year.
Yeah, well, that's right. He's got the 50% discount worth remembering. You can read the next one.
Righto. Ryan says, "Hi, Alan. New listener to the podcast, but a long-time viewer. Been watching you on the ABC News since I was primary school." Me too. That was me. That was me speaking, not Ryan. What do you think about the idea that the RBA could have a lower cash rate for owner-occupier mortgages, brackets buyer and living in your own home, and a higher cash rate for investors? This would lower interest rates of people buying their own home and hopefully reduce the number of investors, in quotation marks, owning many properties that are leveraged to hell. I do know that the cash rate is not just for home mortgages, but let's pretend this could be implemented. And then studies show that owning your own home outright is the number one guarantee for a successful retirement at current rates. My generation will either be forced out into whoop whoop or forever destined to rent and thus facing housing insecurity. Although this wouldn't fix the problem with housing supply. And he says that he's enjoying listening and hope you keep it up. So what do you think?
It's actually what happens. The RBA doesn't have to do it. The way it works, and certainly worked last year, in 2016 mainly, was that APRA started to restrict the amount of investment loans that banks could make, and that meant that they put the price up of investor loans versus owner-occupier loans. So it actually does happen, and there's certainly a different rate for investors and owner-occupiers that banks do, according to the kind of, and it depends on the regulations that APRA puts in. So, I mean, I don't think there are many regulations at the moment. Do you happen to know whether investor loans are a different rate right now to owner-occupier? I haven't looked lately.
In terms of retail offerings, yeah, they're higher. Yeah. There's a lot of talk that those APRA restrictions that you were just mentioning are going to be coming back before the end of this year. ANZ economists reckon that it's definitely going to be happening, and that's going to be one of the brakes that's put on the property market.
Yeah. Yeah, so at the moment, investor loans are higher than owner-occupier mortgages and will probably become even higher still later this year when APRA starts to put the brakes on. So it happens. The RBA will never do it themselves with the cash rate because the cash rate is not aimed at mortgages. It's simply a cash rate. The cash rate is the overnight money market rate for banks lending to each other. And the RBA sets it or influences it by buying and selling cash on the market. So the cash rate is actually a target that the RBA is trying to achieve by its operations in the cash rate. So it's really not possible for it to differentiate between mortgages.
I suppose the only other thing on that is that this property boom, as opposed to the last one in sort of 2015-16, this time it's been built largely on owner-occupiers buying houses.
Precisely, that's right.
And investors have not really been that involved as they were last time.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So the APRA might have to do something else, if that's the case.
I think there's a bit of talk that they're going to start targeting loan-to-value ratios, which I think is fascinating to see the optics on that. If APRA starts saying you can't have anything more than 80% debt, but at the same time the government saying, well, if you're a first home buyer, we'll help you in to get 95% debt. Or if you're a single parent, we'll help you get 98% debt.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Well.
So, Peter, the next question is not actually a question. It's a long statement, so we'll just skip over that, I reckon. Peter, we can't just have that. We need to have short questions, please. Ganesh.
A bit of umpiring.
For my finger's just gone up. My half finger's just gone up. You're out, Peter. That yes, under the
exactly.
arm.
Yeah.
Now, Ganesh, this is long too. I must admit I've always enjoyed listening to you on the Money Cafe. I'm a bit confused about the way the assets are valued in the current economy, considering that nothing much has changed since last year. We're still in lockdown We're still a long way to go. Well, we're back in lockdown, Ganesh, not still. We were out of it for a little while. After the March 2020 stock market meltdown, markets have now fully recovered. Most of the growth stocks are priced at 5 to 10 times what when compared to March 2020 prices. So his questions are, from where is the money coming to raise these prices to all-time high? Do you think that the stimulus money that the government had distributed through creative money policy has gone into the real estate and stock markets? As there is no fundamental change to the financials of these companies, don't you think then that this is a bubble about to burst? The money is coming from central banks printing it. The Reserve Bank has created about $200 billion worth of money in the past 12 months, and that has been transferred to banks. Most of it's still sitting in bank accounts with the Reserve Bank, but it's also supporting lending. The other central banks of the world have been printing billions, trillions of dollars. And so there's been this huge flood of liquidity into the markets from central banks, and most of it's gone into bank accounts. It's sitting there. And a lot of it's being invested, and a lot of it also is going into, in particular in Australia, the superannuation funds inflows have continued. So they're getting lots of money, and that's also pushing prices higher. Is it a bubble? Well, arguably it is, but the trouble with bubbles is they tend to last a lot longer than you think. And just because it's a bubble doesn't mean it's about to burst. I mean, I remember... before you were born, Chris, there was a bubble in 1987, and everyone was saying at the end of 1986 that it was a bubble and it's about to burst, and then it went another 50% higher and burst in October 1987. So, look, you know, these things take a long time.
You can have a lot of fun making money at the late stages of a bubble and then the music stops.
And also the prices aren't that high. The current price-earnings ratio of the Australian market is 21 times, which is above average. The average is over long-term average is 15. So, yes, it's higher than average. But I would say a bubble is 30 times, maybe more.
Really? Okay.
For the market as a whole. So, you know, yes, it's on the way to being a bubble, but it's not there yet. Obviously there are different sectors. I mean, you could make an argument that the tech sector in the UK, the US, is in a bubble.
Go on. I've just written down 30 times because I think I haven't heard you say that before, and I like it because I get asked all the time: is the ASX, are the top companies on the ASX, are they buys right now? And I never really know what to say because they're at record highs and the market's at a record high. And, you know, arguably, you don't really want to buy something that's never been so expensive before. And also, we know that the settings are kind of, the chess pieces are going to change a little bit over the next year or two. So I don't know. It's hard. Is it a bubble? Maybe. I don't know.
That's right. The trouble with bubbles is you can really only tell that it's a bubble in hindsight after it's crashed, because otherwise it's just a boom.
Yes. Well, that's right.
Anyway.
That brings us nicely, I think, to the next question. Tom of Tasmania asks or says, hello again. Thanks so much for putting my question to Ware and to Mr. Turnbull. So this is a repeat person. I was so surprised that I almost spat out my porridge when I was listening. I didn't think much of his answer. I agree on carbon pricing and that the plastic industry has deflected by pushing personal responsibility onto customers or consumers rather than cleaning up its act. But, of course, you didn't have much time for such discussion. The fact that it went out on the podcast is great. Maybe you are a pinko commie leftist, as Father Bob would say. Right, he's getting stuck in here. Okay.
Just ask the question.
Just ask the question.
Whatever the question
is. I'm getting to it.
Tom of Tasmania, hello, with your porridge.
Yeah, right.
You're going on a bit there, mate. Come on.
There you go. His finger's ready to come up. So, okay, what can government regulators do to help with, what's the question? All right, I'm going to ask about, he goes, this will probably come up. What does Cole the Younger think of cryptocurrency? Right, fair.
What do you think?
What do I think? It's a huge question. Look, for me, it seems like it's mostly a vehicle for speculation. And as we discussed, you can make a lot of money in bubbles, but you can lose it fast. Casinos are a lot of fun. But I don't know, the price of Bitcoin now is half what it was in April. I think it's just too all over the place. It's a bit of a tired thing to say at this point, but I think blockchain technology is amazing. Every time I learn something new about it, I get pretty stunned and I'm amazed. But I'm just not so sure about the crypto side of things, because I don't know, you might have a better idea on this, but what's it really linked to? Because currencies, you know, they're attached to sovereign governments and central banks and things. But crypto, it just sort of flies around. You can't spend it on anything, as we've discussed. Having said all that, you know, do I wish I had bought a whole lot of it 10 years ago? Yes, absolutely.
Don't we all?
Yeah. What do you think?
I think they're misnamed. I don't think they're currencies. I think that the problem is the naming of it as a currency. As cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, the word coin and Bitcoin has kind of got everyone thinking that we're talking about money, which is not the case in my view. I mean, I think that what we're talking about is, as you say, these are speculative assets. In the case of Bitcoin and a few of the others, such as Dogecoin, Bitcoin Cash, there's a few of them. All they are is some sort of store of value and a speculative asset. Which is not to say they're nothing. I think that they are, and I think Bitcoin's going to be around for a very long time. But most of the thousands of cryptocurrencies, so-called, that exist are actually tokens that are part of a business of some sort. The trouble is that these businesses are not normal businesses in the sense that they issue shares, that you buy the share and you get ownership of the business and a dividend and so on if they make any money and the share goes up in value. A lot of these things are actual kind of businesses, except that they don't have that kind of ownership structure. So what we're seeing is a change in the way that business operates. They're called decentralized autonomous organizations. They kind of exist. They're software. They've got people running them. A lot of them are kind of foundations, not-for-profit foundations. Some of them are for-profit businesses, but they're not issuing equity in the sense that the cryptocurrency is a piece of the company in the sense that a share is. They're a token that gives you the right to use the business at some point. So a lot of them are what's called decentralized finance operations that are kind of lending or some exchanges or so on. A lot of them are, you know, decentralized finance businesses, DeFi as they're called. And these things are actual businesses in the sense that they do things, but when you buy the cryptocurrency, you don't get a share of it. You get the right to use it in some way. And, that's interesting. I do think the world's changing. I think that, I haven't bought any of these cryptocurrencies. I don't understand them, and I don't trust the idea that you don't get anything much for it. You don't get any ownership and you don't get any kind of promise to pay the money back. But I do think that they're part of a new wave of technology revolution that is going to sweep the world. And I think that the, in particular, the financial world is going to change as a result of it.
Yeah, I think it's amazing that you can attach a unique investment code to things now. The NFT stuff is now going even so far as you can buy moments from your favorite sporting games. You know, I talked about it in a story a couple of weeks ago. You can buy a LeBron James dunk NFT, went for $500,000. You don't actually get the rights to the thing. You get the token that's attached to it. It's really interesting, but and I don't want to kind of come off as a crypto naysayer, because it doesn't really work. Like, it's been around for so long, it's been doing very well, but it does frustrate me a little bit that so much investing by people of younger generations is done on a buy-sell basis. It's really all about the capital gain, and there's not that much time and energy spent thinking about yields and about things like franking credits. And I think that's a problem. We've got to get past that, because you're not getting anything for your money in the bank, and you can get, you know, 4-5% at a decent yielding company, and you get these franking credits too. I mean, I think there should be way more energy put into that.
Everyone's playing pass the parcel, mate.
Yes.
Yes.
That's right. Well, look, I don't know. I mean, just having a bit of a chat about it. I don't know. It's going to be around for ages, and I'm going to continue to be made a fool by the fact that I didn't buy cryptocurrency, I'm sure.
Well, mate, I've really enjoyed our little chat here today. It's been fantastic, and I'll probably see you on the weekend, or if we can get together.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Just lockdown.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm looking forward
to it. I've absolutely enjoyed it as well. It's been great. I've been listening for ages, and I'm thrilled to have been a part of the Money Cafe, even if it's remote. I'll have to I can't throw cricket balls at my three-month-old right now, but I'll definitely do it down the line.
Yes, I'm sure you will. And maybe we'll meet again at another Money Cafe in the future sometime if Channel 9 will let you, and we'll meet in a cafe. And maybe in that vegan cafe near you that you were going to get us into this time, which turned out to be a bloody hotspot, didn't it?
It did. So, yes, I had suggested that we do this at a vegan Money Cafe, at a vegan cafe that becomes the Money Cafe, because then that would let us talk about all things plant-based meats and non-meat alternatives in the booming world of that. Turns out it was a tier 3 exposure site on basically the day that we were going to do it. So it's probably best that we're doing it this way.
Yes, that's right. Thanks for listening, everyone, to today's episode of Money Cafe with my son, Chris Kohler. And send in your questions for next week, and we'll answer them if you email themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. And next week's guest on The Money Cafe with me is another Chris, but this time it's Chris Judd. The director of Chris Judd Invest. Yes, he's an investment person now, and he's the former captain of the West Coast Eagles and Carlton footy clubs. So we can talk a bit of footy and a bit of investment with Chris Judd. So that'll be great. Send in your questions for him. Till next week, I'm Alan Kohler, editor-in-chief of Eureka Report. And you are?
I am Chris Kohler, business, finance, property reporter at Nine News. It's been great to talk to you.
See you next week.